This is Peter Walsh with M&R.
Scott Ritter with the Decorated Apparel Expo.
This is Ben Landisman with Lawson Screen and Digital Products.
This is Deborah Sexton.
And you're listening to the Two Regular Guys
Podcast.
It's hosted by Terry Combs
and Aaron Montgomery.
All right. Well, welcome to the show. It is Friday, January 8th, 2021, our first show of the year. I'm Terry Combs, and you can find me at terrycombs.com.
Ah, 2021. That felt good to hear you say that, Terry. Well, my name is Aaron Montgomery, and you can find me over at oursuccessgroup.com. And today, to kick off the year, go big or go home, right, Terry? We're going to welcome back attorney Gordon Firemark today, and he's going to talk to us and help us navigate this crazy world of copyright, trademark, and all things legal. Gordon was with us back in 2018, and just a wealth of knowledge. And I learned a whole bunch of stuff back then. So I can't wait for what we're going to learn today.
Whatever you believe, whatever you've heard about trademark, copyright, it's probably wrong. So
exactly.
That's what I learned to tune in.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I definitely learned in 2018. What I thought I knew, I was wrong. So this is going to be awesome. But we've got lots of people checking in here this morning. We won't be able to get to everybody. We don't want to waste too much time. We want to get as many questions as we can in front of Gordon. But we appreciate all of you guys checking in, saying good morning. Happy New Year to everybody. Becky says, thank you for doing this podcast. It is needed. Totally 100% true. So we are excited to have Gordon chat with us here in just a moment, Terry. But let's see here. Before we do that, though, I just have a real quick personal news announcement for me to make that I just something I'm very proud of. So I get to sit behind a microphone, so I get to talk about it, right?
Exactly. Right.
Yeah. So anyhow, today's actually the 1 year anniversary of the official kickoff of our success group. So we did our first training exactly 1 year ago today on this date. It was the five keys series about launching and growing your business. And the very first one was determining your overhead. And so that happened exactly a year ago today. And since then, we've done 31 other training classes. We've launched a success support program and created mastermind groups, and basically working to fulfill our mission of providing resources that empower business owners to achieve their idea of success. So I'm just really proud of that, really proud to be part of that community. And thanks to everybody that supported us for this year. And I can't wait to see what 2021 brings for us. So there we go, Terry.
It's been a year. I can't believe it's been a year. It just seems like yesterday, you know, that you guys got that going. So that's really cool.
It definitely, it's like been a whirlwind. Obviously for everybody, it was a whirlwind year, but really excited that we were able to kind of get to where we're at, and can't wait to see where we go from there. So been great. But Terry, we cannot start 2021 without, I think, the thing that most people actually are showing up here for, right? I mean, come on.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. So it is dad joke time. We should get we need to create one of those like little intro things like we've got for five things now too. We'll work on that. But it's dad joke time. And Terry, you've got a good one here, sir. So I'm ready when you are.
I do. It's New Year's Eve related. So this is our first show of the year. So Aaron, do you know what the favorite New Year's Eve drink is for pretentious horses?
I do not know what the favorite New Year's Eve drink is for pretentious horses.
It's Chardonnay.
I like the emphasis too. You really told the joke. That was excellent. Chardonnay. Oh, perfect, Terry. Well, good job on the dad joke. Way to kick us off here for 2021. And if you guys have dad jokes out there, regulators, and those of you that don't know, this is maybe your first time tuning into Two Regular Guys. The regulators are our regular listeners. So thanks to Christine Shreve, we've got a name for our regular listeners, the regulator. So you can use that in hashtag world out there. And people that are in the industry should know who you're talking about. And if they don't, then that's our inside story, right? So all the regulators out there, if you guys have a dad joke you'd like to share, just send it over to us at info@tworegularguys.com or find us on social media or however. We don't have to bring all the dad jokes ourselves. So,
and that's the number two, regular guys.
That's so. Right. That's right. Christine does ask real quick, Terry. Sorry, before we go. Christine asks, are horses capable of being pretentious?
Absolutely. All animals are. it's mostly cats, so I'll just say that.
Okay. But horses have a streak. Okay. I can actually confirm that. When I was a young man growing up, we had horses, and we had a horse that was very pretentious. She knew she was something special, and she made sure everybody knew about it. So,
yeah, not very many people know that you used to be a junior rodeo guy. So
that's right. That's right. All right, Terry, well, let's keep moving here.
All right. Well, Aaron, before we go any further, we want to thank everyone for checking out the Two Regular Guys podcast. We are always looking for new guests. So if anyone you know, or maybe yourself, would like to give us a show idea, go to calendly.com/2regularguys, and share your ideas with us. And we're starting to fill up the first quarter, so we do still have some openings, but let us know what you'd like to talk about. If you're listening to the podcast version, we would appreciate you sharing with your friends so they can become regulators too. Plus, we would love and appreciate you giving us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, or wherever it is you're listening. And we are also now on Amazon Podcasts, so you can find us just about everywhere. If you're watching us live right now, join in with your comments and questions. I have a feeling we're going to get a lot of those today. And please reach out to your industry friends right now to join us too.
Yes, indeed. And again, looks like we've got lots of people joining us, so we're going to get going. We're going to dive right in. So Terry, are you ready to bring Gordon in here shortly?
I'm ready. Let's do it.
Okay. Well, let me tell you guys a little bit about Gordon here real quick, and then he'll be with us momentarily. So Gordon Firemark has practiced media and entertainment law since 1992. He is often referred to as the podcast lawyer and is himself a podcaster, producing and hosting the Entertainment Law Update podcast. Really good one. You should check it out for sure, everybody. Make sure you go subscribe to that after we're done here today. And the newer More Better Faster podcast, which offers insights and advice to creative professionals and businesses who want to achieve more, better, faster. Gordon is the author of the podcast, blog, and New Media Producers Legal Survivor Guide, and creator of several online courses for creatives. His undergraduate degree is in radio, television, and film, and experience in live theater production informs his thinking about all things legal. In addition to his busy law practice, he teaches entertainment law at Columbia College Hollywood, intellectual property and media law at Fashion Industry and Design and Merchandising, and contract law at Pepperdine Law School. So welcome into the program here, Gordon. There we go. How are you, sir?
I'm well. Are you sure it's not Cabernet?
It might be.
Edit. We need an edit right away.
Anyway, hi, guys. Thanks for having me back. It's really good to be here.
All right, Gordon, let's jump right in. And we want to start with, and this is something that we hear regularly, and we're going to hear it in the questions, because all the questions we have been submitted by the regulators, by our listeners. So let's say someone sees a decorator printing a Disney print or DC Comics or heaven forbid, Harley Davidson, and they say, you know, that's copyrighted artwork. Can you explain to the listeners the difference between copyright and trademark?
Yeah. So the first thing is that artwork, when it's a logo for a company or something like that, can be both copyright and trademark protection in play. Copyright is a bundle of rights that are limited exclusively to the author of a work of original creativity, essentially. When the work is fixed in its tangible form, a copyright attaches to it right off the bat, and the author is the owner and the only person who's allowed to make and distribute copies and make derivative works and display or perform the work in public. So that's the right to make the copies and distribute is the big thing there. Trademark is a word or a phrase or a symbol or a logo, like an artwork, that is used as the identifier of the source of goods or services, the source or origin of goods or services. Something like a red triangle on the corner of a package of cookies tells you right away what source those cookies are coming from, right? Or a white swoosh on the side of a sneaker, or the distinctive shape of a bottle, right? You don't have to know what the type of cola this is to know that it actually came from Coca-Cola, right? So those are trademarks. So you can have a logo that is a work of art, a work of original authorship that is protected by copyright as well as protected by trademark. Just a quick example, actually, the design of Mickey Mouse was created almost 95 years ago now. And the duration of a copyright protection is 95 years from the original publication. So the day that Steamboat, or the year that Steamboat Willie is 95 years old, Disney no longer has a copyright on the Mickey Mouse design, but they still use it as the brand identifier, as a trademark. So Mickey Mouse will still be protected from other people using it to identify source or origin. But we may see some knockoff Mickey Mouse stories and products and things like that at that point.
Interesting.
Very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Well, that gives us a nice foundation to start into this then, Gordon. One of the things we're seeing a lot in our industry right now, Gordon, is that this is a time of year, you know, everybody got their crafting Cricut or whatever they got for, you know, and they've gone out and bought a printer and they're getting into the industry. That brings in a lot of people with lots of different ideas of what's legal and what's not legal. And so one of the things that I've noticed a lot of people asking is that, you know, people that are in this legitimately and following proper copyright and trademark laws and whatnot, they kind of take it as a, you know, oh, well, there's this other person out here that's selling these things at $20 a pop, and they're clearly a violation of a trademark. Is there a central location or how do you report some of this stuff? Is this something that we should be worried about as decorators? How do we protect ourselves when we're trying to do the right thing and we see some of our competitors not necessarily following the letter of the law, so to speak?
Well, you know, I think you can certainly report the infringement to the trademark owner. Okay. Trademark owners do have an obligation to police their brand and make sure that people aren't misusing it or using it for improper purposes. But, you know, the layperson probably isn't going to know every single time whether it's actually an infringement or not. And so the brand would then have to run it by its lawyers and so on. And, you know, the risk if they don't police the brand is that they could lose it. It could stop being distinctively associated with them. So they do want to police it. But there's a part of me, actually a big part of me, feels like, you know, focus on your business and don't worry about what other people are doing unless they're doing something that is directly harmful to you. We don't need to be tattletales to succeed in our own businesses. And, what if someone's infringing on someone else's trademark, as long as it's not, you know, directly addressed at your business, I think leave it alone. Yeah. Don't you have better things to do with your time and energy?
Nice. Yeah. I like that answer a lot. That's kind of been my feeling. I mean, you see it and you kind of go, gosh, that person's succeeding and I'm not, but at the same time, well, then what is it that, you know, you're doing that you could be, like you said, focus on your business. I love that. Well, that's a great answer.
The other thing is that because trademarks are protected in different classes of goods and services, it's entirely possible that someone using a well-known name or brand is using it in a way that the owner of the trademark isn't using it. And so it may not actually be an infringement. But again, you got to understand trademark law pretty deeply in order to make those determinations.
Yes. Well,
when Aaron sent this question over to me to put it in the outline, I said, well, Aaron, I can answer this one right now. Snitches get stitches. So
don't do that while he's taking a drink, Terry. That
yeah, I should do a take, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All right. Let's keep going, Terry.
Here's the next one. And this is, as I said, these are from viewers and listeners. So this one says, something I've been wondering about. These companies that sell you graphics, and I think she's referring to clip art, that sort of thing. Then a few years down the road, they tell you they no longer will be supporting those, and it's turning into a subscription service. And basically, you have to pay an additional $50 a month. And And she said that this got me thinking, is it ethical and legal to dump all support for their products that they've sold you? And this also goes along with equipment sales. We noticed that a lot of companies either have end of life of a product and, you know, they've stopped selling the product and they say, well, we don't sell that anymore, so we no longer support it. What's the legal implication of basically buying clip art that's no longer supported or buying equipment that's no longer supported?
Well, it's interesting. I'm not exactly sure what kind of support you would need for clip art other than just, you know, being there to keep it available. If you're going to lose access to something that you've purchased, that I wouldn't call that support. I would call it access. And I do think that, you know, if you make a purchase, they should at least notify you, hey, we're shutting down the website or we're doing whatever we're doing. And so come and download it now. And so you have it. That would make perfect sense and be reasonable. I think if they take away access to something you bought, and I have seen that on stock music kinds of sites where all of a sudden a cue that I've used over and over again is no longer available because the creator or the owner just decided, okay, I'm not going to sell this anymore.
Sure.
You know, what's reasonable? If you bought it on Tuesday and on Friday they said, okay, we're done, that doesn't seem fair. If it's been a year or 2 years, something like that, I think that's pretty reasonable. And in the product and the manufacturing, you know, physical goods side of things, we're really sort of talking about how long is the warranty, right? You don't buy things expecting that they're going to repair or replace it forever and ever and ever. You buy a car, you get a 5-year, 50,000 mile powertrain warranty, right?
Yeah,
After 5 years, it's on you. And the same is true for most products. You know, we have to allow businesses to continue to develop their lines of products and devote their resources to the new stuff and the stuff that's most widely adopted. I mean, I have a scanner back on the shelves behind me that I've had for 7 or 8 years, and they stopped supporting it a couple of years ago. What happened is somebody else popped up and developed a new support software for it, so I can still use it with the new versions of the OS. But, you know, yeah, I mean, Apple does, all the companies do this. They have to devote their resources where they should. And again, it's just a question of reasonableness and what does the original warranty, the contract, say. If they say you're going to have support for 10 years and they'd stop after 8, technically I think they're in violation and maybe you have a basis for a claim.
Yeah. And I think that you make the great point there, Gordon, that a lot of it does depend on, you know, what was that agreement? What was that contract? You know, if you're walking up and down the aisles of a trade show and you go and buy this piece of software and, you know, there's probably not a whole lot of sales receipt or whatever. What's it say on that? Do you get in writing that, you know, if you expect this to be yours for the life and you can go back and access this at any time, do you know that to be the case for sure? So,
yeah.
There are certainly people in our industry that think that you should support something forever. So
more power to them. And I probably like to do business with those kind of people, but not everybody.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Gordon, if you don't mind, can we go back real quick to what we were talking about with kind of the licensing and tattletaling, I guess is the word that pops to mind, but that's not exactly what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. You get the point. But we do have a comment from one of the viewers here. Adrian says, so what about big companies like Etsy? Shouldn't they be obligated to stop their users from selling trademarked items like Disney?
Well, that's a great question, Adria, and it plays into some stuff that's been pretty hot in politics lately, and that is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, DMCA, gives copyright owners the opportunity to get those things taken down by sending a written notice. It's a fairly simple notification process. That's the copyright side of it. On the trademark side, it's a little harder. And, you know, we have some laws in place that are designed to foster and advance the progress or the growth of these internet companies. We, you know, that the Congress saw fit to pass Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, for example. These laws that are in place are set up to create sort of safe harbors for these companies that host the content, but they're not the ones that are creating it. And so we don't want to have them constantly being barraged with lawsuits over stuff that their users are posting online. So they have to have a policy. They have to have rules about this stuff, and they have to enforce the rules when they come to their attention. And so that's a situation where, yeah, maybe the reporting something makes sense. But in the law, we talk about who has the legal standing to make the complaint. And usually that's only the actual owner of the brand.
Yeah.
So, sure, go ahead and report it to, if it's Disney, go let Disney know. And I'm sure their lawyers will get to it sometime this decade. So, they've got a lot on their plate to deal with. And I, as I understand it, Etsy does have some protocols in place to identify that stuff. But it's a little bit like a game of whack-a-mole. One pops up and you bop it down, and then some pops up over here. And
so, yep.
Right. Again, it's an allocation of resources issue. And don't we want these companies to focus on promoting and growing things for the ones that are doing it right, even if that means some bad guys are getting away with things for a while?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. One more quick user question here, comment, and then we'll get on to what we've got on our list here. Eric says, we're creating retro shirts with businesses, bars, restaurants that were in business years ago. Can we get in trouble using their logo? I know at one point you and I had talked about how to find this stuff. Could you maybe share, what's the way that you can kind of look to see if there's opportunity to get in trouble, basically?
Well, if somebody designed that logo, that's a copyrighted work, and copyright, as I said, the protection lasts for basically 95 years. So if somebody out there wants to claim that they're the author of that work, they might be able to make trouble for you. On the trademark side, the branding, if the business is still in business and they're still using that brand, then they've got the trademark rights. The trademark continues indefinitely as long as it's continued to be in use. So unless they've abandoned it and, 5, 6, 10 years has gone by or something like that, you do have to worry about that. Now, a t-shirt I think it was a drive-in movie theater or something like that, featuring some artwork of the theater, probably not an infringement because the theater isn't in the business of selling t-shirts. And so we're in that different class of goods or services. But if the theater is in the business of selling t-shirts as well, then what you're doing is competing with them unfairly by exploiting their brand.
Wow. That's really interesting. I guess that's good to know. There we go. That's lots of great information so far. All right. So, and I guess this does kind of play into the next question on our list here. How can you find if an image is copyrighted or something? The example that this person gave, Renaissance art or famous old masterpieces, these would be things that are over 95 years old. So how do you kind of look if there's some sort of a copyright or trademark on that?
Well, 95 years, if it was created before 1926 now, because we're into the 2021 now. Can you believe it?
Yes.
1926 is the date. So if it was created before 1926, it is, I would say, a very, very safe, although not entirely, there's always a possibility something changed and there's been a revision of it or whatever. But as a basic rule, if it was made before 1926, it's likely to be in the public domain and you could probably go forward and rely on that. If it's been created since 1926, the opposite is true. You should assume that it is protected under copyright law. And the rule is don't use copyrighted stuff. Don't use people's stuff unless they've given you permission, bottom line. So if you're not the owner, don't use it without their permission. And on the trademark side, it is possible to search for ownerships of trademarks. So if there's a brand or a slogan even that someone's using, you can do a basic search on the trademark office website. That's uspto.gov. That's the patent and trademark office, United States Patent and Trademark Office. So uspto.gov, and you go to their search function. It's not a comprehensive search. It's only searching their database of registered and unregistered marks that have been applied for and maybe allowed or not or whatever. You can also get a more comprehensive search if you want to go to the trouble and the expense. I often do recommend, if you're starting a business and building something on a brand, you should run a comprehensive trademark search. costs a few hundred dollars, but if you're investing in equipment and design and manufacturing quantities of stuff, it makes sense to know that you're on safe ground.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah. That's great information. And Eric popped the website up there in the corner for everybody, but there it is, USPTO.gov. So great information. Thank you. Yeah. All right, Terry, what's next?
A pretty good website to navigate through as well, even though it's a government website. So,
well, you know, it's sort of interesting. That's an interesting point you make. The Trademark Office is part of the Department of Commerce, and it is one of the few self-funding government agencies. The fees that they charge for registrations and things like that actually cover most, if not all, the costs of operating the department. And so they are operating more like a business. And what you see in their websites is not the most beautiful design, but it's functional design.
Yeah, right. Definitely.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about artwork. And this listener said, if you buy artwork from someone who claims to have the rights to it, do you automatically get the rights because of purchasing the artwork?
Oh, so the truth of it is, well, look, if somebody claims they're the author of the work and they promise you, yeah, I own it, nobody else is going to have any claims and so on, it's reasonable to rely on those kinds of promises. It's not reasonable to assume that that's the case, but it is reasonable if they actually make you affirmative promises. So you got to ask the right questions. Do you own this? What do I get? I mean, most of the time, if you're buying from a clip art source or something like that, they're going to give you a license agreement that's going to give you those warranties and representations and promises. If you're dealing with somebody, an independent artist or creator or graphic designer or something like that, you want to get these things in writing. So it's important to ask the right questions and make sure that the agreement does include those things. That said, merely paying for something does not automatically confer ownership. You know, when you buy a physical object, the exchange is ownership of the object for the money. When you buy intellectual property, you're buying some kind of a license, and your license, the scope of that is limited. You know, here's what you can do with it, but generally only the copyright holder is allowed to sue for infringement. Now, if you are sued by someone else claiming that they own the copyright to what you have used, and you have that license agreement, you come into the situation saying, no, I paid for a license and here it is. And then oftentimes it's let them go and fight. You sometimes get dragged into the mess, but yeah. So I hope I answered the question.
Yeah.
Well, and here's a different take on it. Again, we tried to group the questions that were similar together. So this listener said, what if I buy copyrighted or trademarked image, and as an example, as sublimation transfers, and the seller infers that they are licensed, could I be liable for trademark or copyright infringement for selling image or selling products with that image on them? So they bought sublimation transfers that had, well, let's say Mickey Mouse again.
Yeah. The short answer is yes, you could be liable. That's why you want to make sure you're dealing with reputable people and ask these right questions, because you know, even though you are acting in good faith, you thought you paid the right people for the rights you needed. You know, it's sort of the intellectual property equivalent of receiving stolen goods. The goods still belong to somebody else, not to you. And so you've used them. You know, you might get off with some kind of an innocent infringer defense or something like that. But most of the time you are liable, and then you get to look to the seller.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's really good point. And, you know, when the question came in, I noticed that said the seller infers that they are licensed. Right. You know, I wrote a big note on my notebook here that say, get a license agreement for all artwork that you're buying. Mm-hmm. I mean, that if it's legitimate, they should have that available for you.
But, you know, in the scenario at the trade show where somebody's out there selling the dye sub things, you know, the iron-ons or whatever else, they're not usually backing that up with a written contract. So, you know, you do take some chances.
Sure, sure. But I would imagine that if you asked them and they would say, yeah, we have that, we'll email it over to you or whatever. So, Good. Okay. Well, let's see here. I just wanted to check and see if there was any comments coming. I know there's lots of great questions here, guys. We're going to make sure that we tackle all the ones that got into us early, and then we'll try to come back and catch any more if we have any additional time for that. But I do want to hit this one real quick, Gordon, because we kind of talked about this earlier with when somebody says you've purchased something and then they kind of go away from that. Mm-hmm. And we can put Peggy's up here, but basically the situation happened where they said it would be available for 7 years. Mm-hmm. I would hope that there's some documentation of that. And now that is no longer there and it's not been 7 years. She asked, what can, should I do?
I think you write to support at the website and let them know, hey, you promised me 7 years. And if you have the screenshot of the terms and services or the written document or something, show them that and say, hey, you promised me 7 years. It's been two, restore my access. And if they don't, and I'm, you know, depending on how much money changed hands, it might be worth your while to take them to small claims court or big claims court if it's big enough. But
yeah.
That is a challenge. I mean, I will say, I think that it's probably a best practice to make an archive of the stuff you buy and keep license agreements with them. So you always have that, even if the website shuts down or, things happen. Businesses, companies go out of business too. And then what do? You don't have support to write to because they're gone.
Yeah.
So, it's an awful situation, but, hopefully the owners will, or the operators of the site will stand by their word.
Sure. Sure. That's great. Yeah. Thank you for that information. Mm-hmm. Okay. So just want to make sure I'm on the right page and we're not going back over the same stuff again here. Question here is, what action can we actually take in the event someone steals our designs? How do we protect our designs? How much will it all cost? You basically saying that often the thieves rely on the fact that people will not take action because of costs. So basically, what's the best way to protect our own original artwork?
Yeah, it's true. There is that element of how much justice can you afford? The good news is you own the copyright the moment the original work is made. Once it's recorded or fixed in some tangible form. And you don't have to go through the registration process. It's not required. You don't have to do anything really to be entitled to the protection of copyright law. That said, if somebody does infringe your work and you decide you need to sue them, you do have to register before you file a lawsuit. Now, there's an advantage to doing registration early, within the first 3 months after you first make available the work, because then you can get your attorney's fees paid and you can get statutory damages. You don't have to prove the dollar amount of your loss. The judge or jury can decide for you that it's somewhere between, $750 to $150,000. So that's the advantage of registration. But, if the infringement is happening in an online forum, like on Etsy or someplace that is hosting images of your work, you can use the DMCA takedown procedure that I described earlier. Basically, you would, search through their privacy terms or the terms of service of the website and find out who the person to write to is. There's also a registry of them. You can get on the copyright office. You can find out who is responsible for these notices at that particular domain. And if assuming that they've registered that, you notify that person there's a particular form, a template for what this notice needs to include. But it's easy. It's a one page, like a letter. Hey, dear so-and-so, we understand, we see that your site is hosting this file at this location and that's infringing our copyright. And I swear this is true. And I'm asking you to take it down. And most of the time that will put a stop to the infringement, because the operators of the website want to be protected in that safe harbor that the law creates for them. And the good news, and the other part of it is that copyright holder, excuse me, not that copyright, the website operator, if they aren't registered with the copyright office for that Digital Millennium copyright agent they may still be liable to you. And then that gives you some leverage with them as well. So, the DMCA is the right procedure if it's online. But yeah, it is expensive to file and pursue a lawsuit. So there are a lot of folks out there that just sort of operate on the taking the chance that nobody's going to do anything about it.
Yeah.
I would say do something about it. Send a nasty letter or a polite letter, you know, be polite first. Hey, you're using my stuff. That's not cool. Stop it.
All right. Yeah. I have a really fast story. Years ago, the Impressions magazine, of flipping through, and there was a shop tour, and the guy's holding up a shirt. It had my graphic on it. And I'm like, what the? So here was and I thought, really, you stole this graphic and you're going to hold it up for a national magazine too? So all I did though was I called, and we had a little come to Jesus conversation, and I think he cried, and so that was my satisfaction, and you know, his promise of never to steal my art again. But you know, what more am I going to do? But at least I called him out.
You know, depending on how important the design and the situation is to your business, you know, you can't sit back and just let people push you around. At some point, you have to stand up and say, my business is going to suffer if I allow these kinds of things to, so you make an example of somebody, and that means you you get a hold of somebody like me, and we file a lawsuit or at least send them the formal cease and desist letter. You know, put the fear of God on them, make them cry a little bit, and then hopefully it doesn't happen again, you know?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. All right, we have three questions here that refer to schools, and two of them to the NFL.
I'll try to get three different answers. No.
Okay.
Perfect.
Okay. Why do all the local schools get by with using NFL logos for their school logo? I was told by a coach that they had permission to use the Atlanta Falcons bird. Mm-hmm. I still refuse to do it for them. And then the next one is, what about school logos in general, especially high schools? Can we print apparel, et cetera, using their logos, whether they are using an NFL logo or one of their own designs without permission? Mm-hmm. If we need permission, do we get it from the school? And then how do high schools get away with using college football logos? Are the repercussions for a decorator using said logo to make apparel for that school?
You know, some of these logos are distinctive and aren't, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Are original enough to be entitled to some copyright protection, and some of them aren't. So the Atlanta Falcons Eagle logo, or excuse me, Falcon logo, is probably distinctive enough and original enough to be entitled to some protection. So, you know, it is entirely possible, and I would say even likely, that the school in question has gotten some kind of permission. I don't know whether the NFL has a sort of blanket policy about these kinds of things, but nobody's going to confuse a high school team with an NFL team, right? You're watching a high school ball game, you know it's a high school ball game. Nobody's assuming that's an actual Atlanta Falcons player down on the field. So so it's not really infringement. Trademark infringement is about likelihood of confusion. So that may be part of what's going on here. Although I do think that there's still a confusion as to whether the Falcons endorse this high school's, you know, ball program and things like that. And so, you know, my guess is that the NFL has some kind of a policy about that. I just haven't investigated it. It's worth exploring. High schools and colleges, same thing. Many college logos are also not distinctive, not original enough to be entitled to a great deal of copyright protection. So if you've got, you know, if your team colors are green and yellow and you've got a letter on the side of the helmet, or, you know, the letter G or C or whatever on the side of the helmet, that's probably not original enough for them to make a case about it. But when it's a design like a Falcon or who knows what else, then there might be. So if you're being asked to print merchandise or goods with the stuff on it, I think that it's reasonable for you to rely on the school's promises that they have what they're supposed to have. But ask them, you know, hey, do you have clearance for this design? Because I see this is the same, you know, same as the Falcons logo. And they should show you in writing if they've got it, or at least sign a contract that says, we warrant that we have all the necessary rights and that we're not asking you to do anything that would amount to an infringement, and we will indemnify you against any liability or claims that might come as a consequence of a violation of these warranties. So you as the printer, as the maker, not the maker, as the instrument of manufacturing, yes, there's some liability there for you, but I think you can protect yourself a great deal by a written contract that specifies warranties and representations, and that indemnity is important. you get sued, you turn around and you sue the school and let the school defend you.
Well, you know, and mixed into that question was, I guess, a little bit different question. For instance, my sons played football at Blue Valley High School in Kansas City. Could a decorator print Blue Valley High School shirts without permission of the school and sell those shirts for their own profit?
I don't think too many public schools bother to register trademarks to protect their brands and things like that. And I'm not sure that Blue Valley High School, for example, would be a trademark because it's a geographic description of a particular institution. So there's nothing really distinctive about that. There could be a Blue Valley, Pennsylvania, and there could be a Blue Valley, Nevada, right?
Yeah,
and they could both call their school Blue Valley High School. So should you make shirts and things like that without their permission? I would hesitate. And if they do have a distinctive logo, I mean, my high school was Palos Verdes High School here in California, and we had a distinctive design of our mascot was the Poseidons, the Sea King. And so there's a really cool design, and you know, that would be copyrighted, whoever created that and granted it to the school. But no, just the words, I don't think there's a trademark infringement situation. Okay. It's just sort of a, you don't want to be the unauthorized one.
Yeah.
Palisade Poseidons, that really rolls off the tongue. It's
we were the Sea Kings is the way we said it.
Yeah, that's awesome. Gordon, we've got another here comment here from Greg. This was a little ways up, Eric. Sorry about that. But he says, what about clip art or fonts used as a logo? Like the University of Nebraska uses the uppercase collegiate font N as one of their trademarks. Can I use that letter on products that I embellish?
It's going to come back down to that likelihood of confusion. If your products are going to create the impression that the University of Nebraska has something to do with your products, either they've endorsed it or authorized it or whatever, then the answer is no. But you know, if you wanted to do something with the letter N that has nothing to do with the University of Nebraska, or you know, then I think you're okay. But you don't go trying to make stuff that suggests a false statement.
I think that's a good rule of thumb for sure. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Terry.
Yeah, the terminology that I've heard is an attempt to deceive.
Yeah. So. Yeah, the legal term in the law, even if it's not a registered trademark, there's a principle called passing off. You know, if you're giving the impression or you making a false assertion of fact or sponsorship or association, the likelihood of confusion is really the test.
Nice. Okay. And then one other thing, while we're talking about the sports teams and stuff like that, there was quite a bit of discussion, not a specific comment that I can share with you, but just quite a bit of discussion about, you know, let's say I go to Joann's Fabric and I buy a bolt of fabric that has, you know, it's a licensed fabric that has an NFL logo on it. Mm-hmm. I've bought that bolt of fabric. Can I, you know, make something out of it and then sell that?
That's a good question. I'm not exactly sure. I think that when you buy fabric at a retail fabric store, the thinking is that you're buying that to make stuff for yourself. And if you were to, I don't know, say it's the Green Bay Packers logo or something like that, if you were to start making pillows and selling them on Etsy or eBay or whatever, and you're making a business of it, I think that the NFL and the team probably would have a basis to come and have a heart-to-heart conversation with you about come to Jesus, as you said earlier.
Yeah.
So I would hesitate about that kind of thing without getting some permission. You could certainly ask the folks at the fabric store, hey, you know, what are the limits of my ability? They probably won't know in the store,
but write to
or write to the NFL and ask them, hey, I bought this fabric. Can I do this?
Yeah.
See what they say.
Yeah,
they may not even know the fabric exists, you know.
Exactly. Then you've got goes up another level. So yeah, and I think a lot of the comments that other folks were kind of sharing there was that a lot of times it does indicate for personal use only. Yeah, so yeah.
Read the limitations exactly.
No, excellent. Okay, all right. So let's keep moving here. Let's change gears slightly. I think a lot of the questions do kind of come up because there is so much confusion about this idea of, you know, what's your intent? Are you, mm-hmm. you trying to deceive or whatever that case may be? But some of the questions are, you know, I've seen designs that are changed a little to mimic a popular trademarked. They say copyrighted design, but again, that doesn't difference between those two. Or what about a parody of something, you know, kind of a satire, or even mashups where you've got maybe a Spider-Man with a Pokemon or something like that. What, how does that all kind of fit into this whole mix?
Different answers for different scenarios. You know, sure. It might be copyright, it might be trademark, and there are going to be different results depending on that. In the trademark space, it's back to that confusion. If it creates that impression that it's coming from the same source as the original, whether you've changed it or not, you know, let's face it, sometimes logos and designs do change over time. And so if you've created a new iteration of that University of Nebraska N or whatever, you might still be infringing. You're probably still infringing if it creates that impression, the overall impression. On the copyright front, it's a little easier to rely on things like parody, or there's a principle in copyright law called fair use that is based on the First Amendment, free speech. If you want to talk about a product, or a copyrighted work, you're allowed to do that if it's criticism and commentary and not having an impact on the market for the original. Now, in this arena, a parody is, you know, poking fun at the thing, right? Mm-hmm. If it's really poking fun at the thing and not some other societal factor, or just being funny at the expense of the copyrighted work. So it's okay to take a small portion for certain kinds of uses. It's a complicated thing. I've got a video explainer of this fair use defense. If anybody's interested, it's at firemark.com/fair use. That's just a shortcut to a YouTube video. So
perfect.
And that's one word, fair use.
Fair use.
So, you know, the short answer is parody is oftentimes a defense against an infringement claim in the copyright space, a little less so in the trademark space, but First Amendment works there too sometimes. So.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Todd says Dr. Seuss is in a legal battle right now over someone doing a mashup of them and Star Trek.
Yeah, actually, the people who did this this mashup, which was titled "Oh, the Places You'll Boldly Go," and it's written in the meter of Dr. Seuss with a lot of the drawings of Dr. Seuss. The Star Trek folk at Paramount didn't seem to care too much, but the Dr. Seuss folks do care, and they're suing. And the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals just decided, I think in the last week or two, that part of the trademark side of the case they threw out, and the copyright side of the case gets to go forward. That they said this is not pure parody, it's too much of a copy. And that's the thing, when you're parodying things, you're only supposed to take the bare minimum necessary to conjure up the idea of the original, to make it clear what you're doing and what you're making fun of. And in this case, they did a painstaking copy of the style and the typefaces and everything involved in the Dr. Seuss books. But adding in the Star Trek theme stuff is pretty fun, actually. But,
yeah, exactly.
So it's awesome.
Yeah, definitely. So real quick, one more question. And I kind of know the answer to this, but I just want to make sure that I'm getting it from you. But Jeff says, how would one find a good trademark copyright lawyer if needed? I think that's firemark.com, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. Now, lawyers are licensed on a state-by-state basis. Now, copyright and trademark are federal law, and so those of us that practice in this area do feel that we can sort of cross state lines to represent folks. But, you know, sort of if it makes sense, if you've got some nexus with our home state. I'm in California. If you're here, definitely look me up, firemark.com, or look me up, and I may know somebody. I can give you a referral. But, you know, ask your friends and colleagues and any other lawyers you know. Who do you know who does intellectual property, who does copyrights and trademarks? And always rely on referrals. Other lawyers generally know who's good and who's not, or who, at least who they like.
Sure. You know? Sure. So. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. The decorators are the same way. So
yeah. Word of mouth is the best thing you can do for anytime you're looking for a service.
Yeah. Nice. Right. Okay.
Okay. Well, here is one that I know we talked about last time you were on, but it, you know, it keeps coming up. How does any large company at a convention print trademark or copyright materials to demonstrate or to give away, and how can they not get in trouble? Check out any SJIA, ISA, ISS, NBM show, etc. And let me add to that. The next question was, something that I see all the time. I know it's copyrighted, but it's for personal use. I think those kind of fit together.
Yeah, well, I'm going to take it in reverse order. The personal use thing, it's still, you made a copy. You know, technically speaking, that is an infringement of the copyright. Where personal use comes into play is you often see at the beginning of the movie you're watching on a DVD or something, this, you know, this video is licensed for personal home use only and so on. That's them telling you don't charge money for people to come see the film in your living room. And that's why that comes up as a thing. But the truth of it is, no, making a single copy is an infringement. Are they likely to sue you over one copy for personal use or even 10 copies for personal use? Probably not. But the moment you're distributing and circulating those copies beyond your immediate family, for example, I think you're going to run into potential trouble. The trouble's there all the time. But, you know, as a practical matter, is a copyright owner going to bother with you over the one copy that you made? You know, if you want to just practice using your equipment and you decide to make a Mickey Mouse t-shirt, is Disney really going to bother to come out? They may send you a letter saying, hey, stop it, don't do that, but it's going to end there, I think. On the other side, on the trade show part of the question, you know, how do they get away with printing copyrighted or trademark designs to give away at the show? The short answer is I don't know, but we shouldn't assume that they don't have permission. There is a robust market for licensing this kind of stuff, and if you were to go to, I don't know, maybe it's Disney and say, we're, you know, manufacturing this product and we're going to give away t-shirts at this trade show, and we'd like a license to use Mickey and Donald and these three other characters. How much is that going to cost? You know, it might be, give us a dollar a shirt, you know, and they may decide that that's still a worthwhile investment of marketing and promotional expense. You know, big companies do have budgets for these kinds of things, so it's definitely feasible to license stuff if the licensors are willing to grant them.
Okay,
but basically, and at our industry, mm-hmm. just about every show, just about every booth, they're printing licensed materials. And I know for a fact that many of them, probably none of them, but many of them do not have permission. And their reasoning is, I'm not selling it, I'm giving it away. And I remember the last time you were on the show, you said, no, that's still wrong.
And that's, again, my answer. It's still wrong. The wrongful act is making the copy and distributing the copy and the derivative work, if it's, you know, an adaptation. The whether you're making money from it or not is really not a relevant part of the discussion. I mean, it plays into, you know, how much money would change hands in a lawsuit at the end of a lawsuit. But other than that, no, I don't think it matters. The liability is still there.
And, you know, you had mentioned last time around that, say, for a sublimation printer, that you're using that licensed product to basically sell your equipment. So, you know, you are, in fact, even if though you're giving it away, you're making money from it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to take it to a little bit of an absurd thing, if that same piece of equipment, that manufacturer was making a TV commercial and they had Daffy Duck come walking on screen and say, you got to get this printer, it's the best, you know, same thing, right? You're using Daffy to endorse your product.
Right.
And you better have a license from, I guess it's Warner Brothers for Daffy Duck.
Yeah. Excellent. Okay. All right. Well, we've gone quite a bit here. Do you have some time? Still got some time, Gordon? You okay?
I'm good.
Okay. All right. Great. Because I do want to try to get to some of the comments that have come in here just as the program's been going. Terry, I know we've got a couple more on the list as well, but maybe we can take a little bit of time and hit a couple of these. And we're not obviously going to be able to get to all of them. Now, I think one of the things that I've kind of taken so far, Gordon, and correct me if I'm wrong here, is that, again, a lot of this does come down to A, first understanding the difference between copyright and trademark.
That's a good one. We should call it copymark.
Copymark and
copymark.
Copymark, yeah. Good. There you go. We got a brand new podcast for there you. New brand. So does that mean that I now own? Okay, never mind. We're not. No. Good. anyhow, my point being is that a lot of this does come down. And then what's your intent with it? Correct. I mean, kind of is the intent to basically make people think that you're being endorsed by whoever actually owns that? Or is it different? Is it, so help me navigate that a little bit.
You know, I think intent in many situations, especially in crime situations, intent is an important factor in the law. In copyright and trademark issues, intent is less of a factor than the impact or the effect. So it doesn't matter whether you intended to create confusion. It's whether or not there's a likelihood that confusion will exist or does exist as a result of what you've done. So if actual confusion occurs, then doesn't matter whether you intended it. That's what happened. That's the infringement. In copyright, the intent is to make the copy or make the distribution happen or the derivative work or display the work, whatever. So the intent is pretty easy. If you did it, you intended to do it, right? And nobody inadvertently makes copies of
that makes sense. Okay. Nice. Okay. All right. Okay. So another question here then from a viewer, and this is way up there, Eric. So since I have it in front of me, I'm going to hit it. But Nan says, how does using certain words work that are said to be registered, like cowgirl? Are you not allowed to use that?
So trademark law is pretty interesting about in that we don't take single words out of the lexicon very often. And certainly if you're not, I mean, the example of cowgirl, I'm trying to think of an example where cowgirl would be a trademark for some, you know, cowgirl brand chewing gum might be something because it's, you know, it's fanciful. It doesn't really, but if you're talking about cowgirl clothing, that's a descriptive term, not a distinctive identifier of source, right? Now you might eventually get cowgirl brand or Wrangler is an example. Wrangler brand jeans and other, you know, sort of Western wear, right? Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean you can't say the word Wrangler or you can't use the word Wrangler in another, you know, cattle wrangler or in training or something like that on a t-shirt would be fine because we're not invoking the brand. We're not suggesting a connection between them. But if you start adopting the exact same logo and typeface or the way it appears, then maybe you are. So it's really just going to come down to the specifics of the situation. But no, as a general rule, we don't take a single word out of the dictionary and say you can no longer use that word. In fact, when you apply for trademark registration, they often insist that you disclaim certain words or even phrases because they're sort of common usage.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. So like Super Bowl, I mean, that's always one that comes up this time of year.
Well, right. Now, I guess I could make a product that holds popcorn and call it a Super Bowl.
Yeah.
But I better not refer to an entertainment service or a sporting event or a television program by that term, because now I'm infringing on something that belongs to the NFL. That's a different class of goods and services. But the words Super Bowl separately aren't protectable. It's the unique combination of those in connection with these kinds of goods or services.
Nice.
And okay. The NFL does take a fairly broad, expansive view of that. So,
and they've got deep pockets to to go after that, right?
I love the idea of a Super Bowl. Maybe S O U P E R.
There you go. That'll be awesome. Yeah. And I think that really, to me, kind of sums up a lot of this then pretty well. It's again what that I keep saying the word intended, but it's not intended. How does that fit? So if you're using Super Bowl, like you said, around those things, that is the Super Bowl sports entertainment television, then yes. But if it's a bowl of popcorn, that's a different deal. So interesting. Okay. Terry, what else do you got there?
Let's see here. How about this one? I thought this was kind of interesting. What if I take a picture of a well-known person or place? Can I create something from that as an artist?
Oh, wow. Tough questions here. my instinct is to say no, because there's something called the right of publicity. It doesn't just apply to famous people, but it's most often used by famous people. We each have a right, and some states recognize this more broadly than others. This is one where state to state things change. The basic principle is if you're using a person's name or likeness, in a commercial way, that is a violation of their right of publicity unless they've given permission, right? We have the right to control commercial uses of our name, likeness, and things. Here in California, it extends to things like the sound of a person's voice. There were cases involving sound-alike singers of Bette Midler and Tom Waits and people like that, very distinctive sounding voices. It's like trademark, right? If you're going to create the impression that that's the person singing, that's not okay without their permission. That said, there are some cases, and you know, like a, I think there was a commemorative plate featuring Tiger Woods on it, and I don't remember. I think it went in his favor eventually. So you know, this is the general. I wouldn't make artwork that uses likenesses of famous people. You know, you don't want to use a Marilyn Monroe likeness or an Elvis Presley image on a t-shirt without permission from those estates, because frankly, you just don't want the lawsuit. Even if you end up winning, it's millions of dollars down the drain.
Yeah. That's a great point there. So Valerie asked a bit ago, can we circle back to the notion of whether that drive-in is in the business of selling shirts? She wasn't real clear on that.
Okay. Well, assuming that the design that we saw on that shirt, and let's not go back and show it or anything, but you know, assuming that the design on there was a new original design, and so all it did was mention the name of the drive-in,
okay,
you know, Happy Valley Drive-In or whatever on the front of the shirt, with some kind of an original design, unless the drive-in theater also makes and sells shirts that say Happy Valley Drive-In and have, you know, made t-shirts part of their business, they are not selling t-shirts. They're not in the business of attaching the brand of Happy Valley Drive-In to their physical products. What they're doing is offering a service, providing screenings of films and serving food. That's where their real business is, by the way.
Right.
So if they aren't in the business and using the trademark to identify the goods and services in question, the shirts, then they don't have a basis to sue you for it. As a general rule, they're very famous brands have another principle called dilution, where they know that just the fact that there are products in other categories out there with those brands could dilute the value of their existing brand because it undermines the sense of quality or whatever. But for less famous brands, it really comes down to, are they operating in the same classes of goods or services? There are 45 classes or so of goods and services that you can register trademarks in. So here's an example. I mean, it's sort of a preposterous one, but if you wanted to create, you know, double mint medical products, right? The chewing gum people don't have any business telling you can't make medical products unless they also make medical products and have registered in that class. Trying to think of another silly example, Coca-Cola sneakers. Although that's actually something, it's a very strong, famous brand. And so they could say, yeah, if sneakers come out with the name Coca-Cola, people are going to think it came from us. There's that confusion.
Yeah.
And that's diluting our brand thing. But I would say stay away from it. But
yeah.
Valerie, if Happy Valley Drive-In isn't selling shirts, you should go call on them because they should be. So,
yeah, he can just get make their permission. Make a
deal that you're the exclusive manufacturer of Happy Valley Drive-In t-shirts.
Exactly.
And give them, you know, sell them to them at you know, just above cost, just profit above costs at their physical location. And then you sell them everywhere else around town.
There you go. Exactly.
There you go. Perfect. All right. Next question here from Jim. How do you prove you own the copyright without filing for a copyright?
Well, if you can prove when you created the work, which nowadays in digital terms is pretty easy, you know, file dates and things like that. Yeah, it can be forged. But, you know, all you have to do in a lawsuit is, you're going to have that copyright registration. But ownership of copyright comes from authorship. So all you have to do is allege, I created this work on this day and time. And if you've got some evidence of that, it's useful. Now, that does not mean put it in an envelope and mail it to yourself. That doesn't work. It doesn't help much at all, because a good lawyer could tear that apart in a very short order. The mail, you don't have to seal an envelope to send it through the mail. So that doesn't prove anything really. But if you've got a digital file on a computer and you can show, hey, the creation date was this, and here's what's in the file, you know, those kinds of things. Copyright registration it's not a particularly expensive thing for a single work, but when you do, you know, creating something every day, it adds up. It's $35 to $55. I think it's about $55 now for a typical a copyright registration. So if you've got a valuable design, you should register it. I think that's important.
Yeah, definitely. Okay.
But keeping good records is really the answer.
Okay. Wonderful. That's perfect. So we've got some questions in here in the comments about military logos, military names. How do those kind of fit into all this? Do they, I mean, I guess they would function just like a football team or something like that, right?
There are limits to what intellectual property the U.S. government, what intellectual property the U.S. government is allowed to own. So I would have to go look, because I know that the Army does, you know, the Army, Navy, all of the branches do make goods and you know, and try to protect them. So that's a good question. I don't know that I would want to take the chance, especially if there could be trademarked logos and designs, you know, the specifics of the layout and arrangement of the t-shirt and so on. But things like the olive drab color and the star, you know, those kinds of things you could use and combine to make your own kinds of goods and services pretty easily. And even the word Army or Navy or Air Force, you know, those are descriptors, not distinctive terms.
Yeah. Okay. Question here from Carlos and Eric, if you've got that one there, it says questions on high school logo images. How much do you have to change it to avoid any repercussions?
That's the wrong question.
Okay. All right. Good.
It is never about how much do you have to change it.
Okay.
If you didn't create something original, then you shouldn't use it. If you're copying something, even if you're changing it, you're still copying. You're making a derivative work. You're adapting the thing. So changing something isn't the answer. Making something original is. Now, an original thing can evoke or call to mind something else. And that's okay. In fact, that's encouraged. But you don't start with the thing on your screen and then manipulate it, because now you've made a copy and you're making something derivative from it. So that would be copyright. I mean, again, once it's so far away from the original that nobody would conclude that it's based on the original, then you're okay. But that's a pretty big leap.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, perfect. That great answer to that. Next one that I've got here. And can you talk about trademarks being owned by multiple people? A phrase I looked up is trademarked by four different people under different trademark numbers.
Yeah, different classes of goods and services. So that's an example of, you know, the medical device people and the sneaker people and the chewing gum people all owning the brand for their particular kinds of goods or services. And that's the way the system works. So, we don't take things off the market across the board until it becomes a very famous brand, a Coca-Cola, a Xerox, a Nike, you know, those kinds of things.
You know, here's an example. I think of what you're talking about. I used to work for a company originally called J&M Sportswear.
Yeah.
And not until we started selling into the golf marketplace did we have any issue. But then Johnson & Murphy Shoes said, well, we sell golf shoes, and now you're selling in our marketplace under J&M. We're J&M. So J&M had to change their company name to Jones & Mitchell Sportswear because they had stepped into a marketplace where somebody owned that name in that marketplace. Is that?
Yeah. I mean, the truth is the class of goods or services is broad, and it's going to be shoes, maybe athletic shoes, right? But So the infringement was happening before Johnson & Murphy ever found out about it. But it was when it entered their marketplace that they became aware of it and recognized it as some kind of a threat. So if they were doing J&M and the company you were with was also a J&M, they were confusion in the marketplace.
And let me tell the listeners out there, that meant cutting labels out of thousands of shirts, changing the signage on the building, throwing out every business card, changing the website. It was it was an expensive endeavor.
Rebranding is something you want to do when you choose to, not when you're forced to.
Exactly. Hey, Aaron, we had one more question that was posed to us earlier that I thought it's kind of interesting. I think maybe we've addressed it, but someone said they own several antique cars and would like to sell items with those logos. And in other words, I think what they're asking is maybe it's Hudson or something like that that's no longer being built. Would that be okay to do if it's not, I mean, that company is no longer in business, I assume.
Well, if it's Hudson, or I'm trying to think of, you know, or DeLorean for that matter, you probably in an area where the trademark has either been abandoned or expired. But if you're doing, you know, a t-shirt with the picture of the Edsel on it, I would not include the Ford logo, except maybe within the picture of the Edsel itself. But don't say Ford or put it on the back or, you know, those kinds of things, because Ford's still a trademark that people are using.
Poor Edsel Ford.
Yeah.
Never name a car after yourself. It's
Oh man, the Gordon, that would be a funny one.
I don't know if you guys remember the Dale. That was there you go. So, sorry, we're
getting way off. There have actually been a few of those, you know, the Cooper too, right?
Yeah, that's true.
But anyway, okay. Yeah. So, you know, bottom line, if it's a logo or a brand that's still in use, stay away. If you're sure it's not still in use and it's been more than a few years, then I think you're okay to reference it, as long as, you know, you can do that trademark search and make sure that somebody else hasn't already come into the space and started using it in a similar way. But yeah. You're
okay. This, I think this is probably just part of a lot of the questions that are out there, but you know, so let's say, you know, you make something, you think you're in the right, but you know, you get that letter, you know, like Terry talked about, you know, they had to change labels and different things like that. You know, I think a lot of this kind of comes down to that. You got to do the best you can to do the right thing. What's the worst case scenario, and what's more common when you kind of get caught?
Well, I mean, the worst case scenario is that this can be bet your company stuff. You know, if you want to fight over this kind of stuff, you could end up in a situation where you're spending millions of dollars on legal fees and ultimately maybe even paying out a judgment. Mm-hmm. Even if you win, the legal fees are going to be substantial. But I think that what's important is you get some advice, because often as not, a lot of times what will happen is an owner of a trademark will either think they've got stronger rights than they do, or, you know, if you're in the different class of goods or services, they may try to intimidate you and say, hey, we own a trademark, you better stop what you're doing, or whatever. Or you may have that fair use argument that it's, you know, you're using, yes, it's a copyright design that you're using, but the way you're using it is allowable. I my answer is, I think you got to get some legal advice. Yes, lawyers charge money for their time, and it may feel like a lot of money to get some advice, but if you're going to be abandoning a whole line of business or cutting the labels out of thousands of shirts, maybe that investment is worth it before you go to the trouble of caving in to an unreasonable demand.
Yeah.
The lawyers will know whether it's reasonable or not.
Yeah, exactly. And like you said, yes, you're going to pay for that advice, but at the same time, that's an investment. Yeah. You know, is it worthwhile in that? Because if you're doing this and this is your business, that's part of being a business, is you have to be able to make investments in these types of situations. So, all right, a couple more, one more, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, Aaron, we are in Gordon's second hour of billing. So
I know. I was just going to take it out of your paycheck, Terry. So, so Kelly asks, Chanel logo reproduced on a shirt, infringement. Chanel logo hand painted in an art gallery, not infringement? ?
In the art gallery there, that's a great question, Kelly. Thank you. Yeah. In the art gallery scenario, because what you're selling is art, you're not you're not attaching it to goods or services. I mean, I guess the painting is a good, but it's generally a one, even if it's a multiple poster. You know, Andy Warhol did his Campbell soup can thing, right? And actually the Campbell soup people were thrilled with that, but leave it. So the Chanel logo on an artwork, what's happening is you're selling art, and Chanel, I guess they could argue they're in the art business too in some ways, but no, I mean, I think this is where First Amendment free speech, we protect art differently because it's a sort of non-commercial in context. Yeah, you're selling the physical good of the art, but you're not in the business of selling multiples and maybe, I don't know. The short answer is, yeah, I think in many instances, it would not be considered infringing to create an artwork. But if it was a hand painted logo that then gets, you know, put on shirts or lunchboxes, then yeah, it is.
Yeah. Good. All right. Yeah, there's lots of other questions, you guys. It's fantastic. And hopefully we've given you a nice coverage of a lot of this stuff. I know for sure we feel that way, Gordon. This has been fantastic. Cleared up a ton of stuff. So let's hit this question because it kind of leads into where I want to take this next is, Evelyn says, what are the average costs for services? So for you, for example, what is somebody looking at to work with you here?
Yeah, that's always an embarrassing question, but
I know it's tough, but
so, you know, look, legal fees range, you know, I think that lawyers who do this kind of work probably charge anywhere from $250-$300 per hour upward. I know there are some lawyers that make over $1,000 an hour. I'm sort of in the middle right there. I charge about $600 an hour for most of my time and doing this kind of stuff. But, you know, registering copyrights and trademarks, a lot of us work on flat fees, and it's not as frightening as it sounds. But, you know, again, it's an investment, and it's part of the cost of doing business sometimes.
Yeah.
A little bit of advice, having a half-hour meeting with a lawyer, you know, a couple hundred bucks might ease your mind a lot. So maybe it's worth doing.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I totally agree with that. Just like I said, half hour conversation, be prepared, go into that thing prepared with all of the specific questions that you have and, you know, don't waste time kind of beating around the bush. And I think
many of us do an initial sort of free consultation, just to really more get to know you, or is it a good fit? Is there something I can do to help? But you might get enough answers from that to at least decide whether to go forward. So don't hesitate to pick up the phone and call someone and ask these kind of questions. You know, don't lead with what do you charge? Lead with, here's my situation. Can you help me? And then get to, okay, how much will that cost?
Yeah. That's good. Good. That's awesome. All right. So Gordon, talk to us about it. You know, it's been a couple of years since we've been here. What's new and good for you? I know you got some great stuff out there. I know we got at least one thing we want to share, but what else is going on with you?
Well, you know, I'm plugging along. It's been an interesting year, that's for sure. The last couple of years actually. But, my mission is to help as many people as possible. I aim a lot of my practice at, you know, I'm mainly an entertainment lawyer. So I aim a lot of my practice at the film and television business. Live theater is another area of my practice that I just have a passion for, and podcasting. And I represent a lot of podcasters. I help a lot of podcast networks do their thing. And my goal really is to help 10,000 creative people over the next few years to realize their dreams and achieve their goals. And to do that, I'm going on as many live streams and podcasts as I can, and just having fun sharing this knowledge and information, giving people the tools they need to make their dreams come true. So thank you for the opportunity to be here and do that. And you can find out all about me at firemark.com is the law firm website. I also have one at gordonfiremark.com, which is where I offer some services and online courses and things like that. So
excellent. Excellent. So what about, I hear about a toolkit, a legal toolkit that's out there. What, tell us a little bit more about that.
I have one of the products that's available is the Digital Entrepreneurs Legal and Business Toolkit. It is a course, a fair bit of instruction on all of the stuff we're talking about here today and business setting up LLCs and corporations and copyrights, trademarks, patents, all those kinds of things. And we also include a bunch of template forms and contracts for digital online businesses. And you can find that at, I gave you a link and
I forgot
which one.
No, it's
DIYbizlaw.com. Yep.
Awesome. There you go.
Director is putting things up on screen. For
he, Eric is amazing. He is, he makes us look good. So, yeah. So check that out. DIY Biz Law and Gordon, you're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all those places as well, right? Somewhat.
You can't avoid me. If you search for me, G Firemark is the handle I use on most services. On Instagram, it's Gordon Firemark, but I don't use that one that much. So,
yeah. Okay. All right. Well, Gordon, thank you so much. Amazing. As usual, we really appreciate it. So we can hopefully maybe do this again a little more quickly. I don't know why it took us so long.
Anytime. It's always fun, guys.
Thank you. Awesome. Thanks, Gordon. Wow. Terry, is it sinking in yet?
I tell you, I love having Gordon on the show. I, you know, when I teach my classes, I have a lot of people ask me these kinds of things and I answer them to the best of my knowledge, but I always feel like I'm armed with a little better information after, after listening to Gordon. So,
yeah. Yeah. It's great listening to Gordon, learning a ton and, you know, getting the reality. I think one of the things that makes this so difficult is there is some gray area, I think is what it kind of, what comes up, not necessarily gray area to the, what the extent of the law is, but there is some interpretation, I guess, of different things that, requires you to have to, again, retaining the services of an attorney like Gordon is probably a worthwhile endeavor. If, you know, your business is based on the use of these things, you know, you have your own art that, is that kind of thing, or you're getting a little too close to touching some things that you probably shouldn't be, you know, that kind of thing. So,
yeah, when in doubt, don't.
Yeah. I think that's the when in doubt, don't is the good. And, you know, because I think what happens is you go, oh, well, I'm not big enough for that. Well, it doesn't necessarily matter. It's if they find it, that they can do something about it. And do you have enough money to protect yourself from that? So that becomes to me the judgment is where do you go with that? So we'll leave the discussion about all of that to Gordon though. So again, check him out over there at firemark.com and definitely look into that DIYbizlaw.com. I think that's real worthwhile. I just saw it this morning, so I'm going to look into it a little bit more myself here, Terry. So
sounds like a great idea.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, we are well into bonus time, but we still got a couple things left here, Terry. The five things. It's we need to do five things here. So we've got a video. So Eric, you want to click two videos, and we'll get through five things here. Hey everyone, Aaron Montgomery here from Our Success Group. Today I wanted to share with you five things. So these are five reasons why you should be part of a mastermind group as a small business owner. So here we go. Number one, accountability. Pure accountability to help you get things done, even the hard things that you might not want to do. Number two, having support, having that team that has your back, even as a solopreneur. Number three, creativity. Diversity brings creativity. And it helps you solve problems. Number four, extra resources. Resources are not just money, but can be things like building ideas, bringing ideas, and connections. Number five, confidence. Through the four things we talked about previously, your confidence is going to soar, as well as having that team behind you to work towards a common goal. So there are the five things. I'd love to see some discussion around these five things. Why are you in one? Why are you not in one? What reasons did I miss? What reasons resonate with you? Whatever the conversation is, I would love to hear that. So make sure that you get out there on social media, use the hashtag five things, and I will keep an eye on that. And hopefully we can have a great conversation.
All right.
That's my
very good. Well, Aaron, we talked about giving our listeners some ideas of five things that they could do. So I did a little short list here, if you don't mind me reading through that.
Yeah, please. That's great. And again, we want you guys to be submitting these things. I just happened to record that because we needed one. I know Terry and Eric are going to do one. But if you guys want to record something, you want to send it to us, whatever you want to do. We just want these five things to kind of get out there to like start piquing the conversations, get them going. And Terry's even got ideas for you. So here you go, Terry.
Yeah, here they are. All right. here are the ideas. The five best purchases I've ever made for my business. Next is the five people who have impacted my career most. The five best tasks or jobs you can outsource for your business. Five things people warned me about when I started a business that weren't true. Five things I believe will change in our industry over the next 5 years. and last five suggestions for a better online presence for your business. So that's just a variety of different subject areas, because I know people say they want to get involved in five things, but they just can't think what five things. So these are starting points, and we'll try to give you more ideas as in future shows as well.
Yeah. So we want to hear from you guys. Great ideas from Terry there. Six ideas for five things. So number soup. No.
And you used to always, when you do your five things, you used to always add one. And here's a bonus.
I know. And here's a bonus. And so you got a bonus. This is Terry's five things for five things, and it's a bonus. But again, we want you guys to participate in this. This is about what you guys want to talk about. Use Terry's ideas, come up with your own ideas, send them in to info@tworegularguys.com. Again, you can record a video and send that to us. You could record audio on your phone and send that to us, or you can just send us the list and we'll read them for you, whatever you do. And we'll say who they're from. We'll actually link your website into our show notes. And that helps your Google ranking, because you've got somebody linking back to you. So any of that kind of stuff always helps. And so participate, join in, and bring a five things to the table. Looking forward to that. And then one quick comment in here, Terry, that Trina said, good podcast. Sorry, I caught the end. Will it be reposted? And Eric actually already answered this, and so appreciate that. But he says the podcast is available with the same link that you got here and on the YouTube page after the show's live, once the video processes. So yeah, about 5-10-15 minutes after the show's over, it'll be right back at that exact same link, all ready to view. So in fact, I think YouTube's pretty much instant. So so check that out if you're just catching the end of it. And Terry Becky says, go Chiefs. So
all right.
yes indeed.
So, Super Bowl.
And Christine asks, is there a limit on how many five things presentations we can do propose? No limit. We've got, you know, how many more? We got 49 more shows to go this year. So we need at least 49
in our ninth year.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, for sure. Okay, Terry. So what's coming up for you? And then let's get out of here.
All right. January 26th, I'm going to be participating in the Impressions Connect, and you can find that at impressionsconnect.com. I'm going to be doing a presentation called Sportswear Garage, Starting a Home-Based Screen Printing Business, and starting to schedule in-person classes, Aaron. A complete screen printing business course with Atlas Screen Supply in Chicago. I'm going to be there May 22nd and 23rd, August 21st and 22nd, and November 6th and 7th. And you can watch for, I'm starting to fill in my terrycombs.com events page. So go there and check it out. Aaron, what do you have coming up?
Yeah, hit the terrycombs.com tour dates, I believe is what it is. Tour dates. Did you change the name? Okay, cool.
No, I didn't.
Okay, all right. I understand. So for me, tomorrow morning, got Small Business Saturdays happening. It's at 8 a.m. Central Time, and we're going to have Christine Shreve joining me. We're going to review the Success Principles program that we did at the end of last year, and there'll be you can go and find that as well and check out all those previous videos. But we're talking success principles. Christine's going to come in, help me out, give me her take, just have a really fun conversation tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. Central Time. And you can check that out over at liveosg.com, which takes you to our YouTube page, or you can find it at facebook.com/oursuccessgrouppro. And then, Terry, next week we kick off the revamp version of the five keys that I talked about earlier from our success group. And this five keys is about launching and growing your business. That's going to happen on January 13th. So there's still time for you to become a member. If you just want to go over to oursuccessgroup.com/membership, and you can register right there. You not only get the live upcoming training courses, but you'll also get the 32 past trainings plus access to our private members group and lots of other little perks and stuff that we throw in whenever we can. So that way we can support our members. And a little giving it away here, but if you use 2RGS as the coupon code, that'll get you 20% off whatever membership or program that you're looking to add over there. So nice. So I wanted to share that with the regulators and let them have an opportunity to join our success group as well. And then you mentioned Impressions Connect. I will be presenting there as well. Eric is also. But my presentation is called Conquering Fear and Living to Tell About It. And so I'm excited about that. It's going to be kick off on January 25th. And like Terry said, you go over to impressionsconnect.com and check that out. So that's what I've got going on. And
I was just going to say, and they have events all that week. So go make sure you go and check out. This is basically in place of the the kickoff show that we always do in Long Beach, California with Impressions Expo. They did postpone that show for a few months, but this is kind of to fill that space. And would you like me to read through Eric's?
Yeah, we can do that. Let me hit one comment real quick, and then I'll ask you to do that if that's okay. And I know I'll put this one up there. Elise says, awesome. I'm glad TRW recommended you guys on his live last night. Yeah, thanks very much to Matt for sending people over. We appreciated everybody being here today, and hopefully you guys got a lot of great information out of it. Hopefully you've also liked and subscribed on YouTube or liked our Facebook page, whatever. And then if you'll check out tworegularguys.com, we always put the show notes up. Sometimes it takes me a week or so to get them up, but I'm going to try to get this one up here either today or tomorrow, depending on how the rest of the day goes here. And then so you can check us out at tworegularguys.com. In there is all the links to everything that everybody's posted. We've got the past. You can listen to the podcast version. You can find where to find us on different podcast platforms and stuff like that. So yeah, we appreciate you guys all being here. And thanks to Matt for sending people our way. And then
you can go listen to some past shows where Matt's there accepting awards. So.
Exactly. And Matt's been on the program before. It's been a little bit though, so probably going to get Matt back to see what's new and good over there for sure. So look for Matt on Two Regular Guys sometime this year as well. So I'm putting Absolutely. That out there now. Matt, you're on notice, sir. And then Becky asks, Casey Dax, you going to be there, Terry?
I'm going to be speaking, but all the seminars are going to be virtual. So I'm not certain that I will be attending. Eric, Aaron, you're probably going, I would assume, since it's close by.
Yep. I'll be at all the DAX shows. So we'll see if we can figure out a way to make it happen. I'd love to have you and Eric out there with me too. So we'll work on that. That's we'll see. So just try to keep your calendar open if you can though, Terry.
I love going to Kansas City. So
I know you do. We can go get some barbecue there, right?
Exactly right.
All right.
Light district.
Yep. So what's Eric got coming up here, Terry?
Eric will also be at the Impressions Connect. He's presenting on 3D foam and on e-commerce. So check that out. And the schedule is up there at impressionsconnect.com. You can join Eric on his show at 2:30 Mountain Time today. That is The Take Up. And today it's Learning Machine Embroidery Digitizing. Multiple modes makes it work. And he says we'll be talking about learning modes and what you need to learn to digitize for embroidery. And Eric, I'm sure, is going to pop up there about the links. And Eric also has a new class coming up, I see here in the notes. And Aaron, do you know anything about that?
I do know a little bit about it. We're just tease this here a little bit. If you'll go over to decorators.education/DNLH, you can sign up right there. There's a you can buy his previous one there if you'd like, but if you're also looking for what he's got coming out in the new, there's a form that you can fill out, and you'll be one of the first to know when the new training comes out. But we're still working out all the details, but talking about patches is what I think is on the plate right now. So Eric will we'll get that sorted out, and but look for that coming up this year. So that's one of the things that's on there. So we're excited to get that going with Eric. He did a fantastic class a while back, and we need more on the decorators community side over there. So thanks for Eric for putting that together, and looking forward to that. So all right, I think that's about it. Let's just make sure we're got comments and everything else coming at me here. Peggy said, I thought Matt was going to pop in today. Matt was actually in the comments earlier. I don't know how long he was able to be around, but Matt was there was talk about him being the legend and whatnot. So good stuff there. All right, Terry. Well, hour and 35 minutes. I think that's a good show for the day. Thanks very much. Could be. So thanks very much to Gordon Firemark for answering all of our legal questions. We tried to get to, again, as many as we could. Make sure that you check him out over there. And let me get the link again. It's DIYBizLaw.com is where you really want to check out, or you can find him at Firemark.com as well. So again, thanks very much to Gordon for his time today.
All right. We also want to thank our show producer, Eric Campbell. And Eric had extra duty today with all the comments. You can find him at ericcampbell.com and also at The Take Up.
Excellent. Yes. And Terry, next week, we would have normally done this show this week, but we couldn't pass up the opportunity to have Gordon on. So we switched them up. Next week, we're going to do our annual show where we talk about 10 things we'd like to see in 2021. So I'm really looking forward to that. We've been doing that. I think we've been doing that pretty much since we started the show too, if I remember
think,
right.
I think so too. So this is probably the eighth or ninth time. So.
Yeah, definitely. It's going to be a good one. So looking forward to that. Make sure you guys, if you're new to us, just like, subscribe, and get back here. And let's talk about the 10 things. Basically, we're dusting off the crystal ball, and we're going to try to predict some things and see what's coming up. So we want to hear what you guys think as well.
All right. Until then, I'm Terry Combs. He's Aaron Montgomery.
And we are the Two Regular Guys.
Here we go. We're out!
Awesome.
Thank you for listening to Two Regular Guys. Check out our website at tworegularguys.com. That's the number 2regularguys.com. You can also interact with us over at our Facebook page, facebook.com/tworegularguys, or send us a tweet, twitter.com/tworegularguys. And we have a YouTube page. You can find all that from our website, tworegularguys.com. Thanks for tuning in, and we look forward to spending some time with you again next week.